Support comes from Empower Missouri's Affordable Housing Coalition, working to address the causes of housing insecurity and homelessness through tenant advocacy. Information at empowermissouri.org/housing.
After easily winning in a challenge for re-election on Tuesday night, St. Louis Treasurer Tashara Jones chose to reflect on one of the unmistakable themes of the 2020 Missouri primary, Black women prevailing in bruising and often personal elections.
Can I just put a pin there and talk about the wave of Black girl magic that's hitting Missouri right now? Can we talk about that? Woo.
Jones pointed to Democratic wins by candidates like St. Louis Circuit Attorney Kim Gardner and, of course, Democratic 1st District Congressional nominee Cori Bush. So on this edition of Politically Speaking, St. Louis Public Radio's Rachel Lippman and Jacqueline Driscoll break down these results and talk about what they mean for November. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
It's a little complicated in Bolivar because there is a Parsons family there.
But we also knew that it was important to make sure that we got to where we needed to go.
You know, if you walk in a room and you're getting ready to make a decision and everybody in the room looks like you, you need to stop.
And right now what happens in the United States Senate is as critical as anywhere else in the country.
I really want the state to succeed.
We want everybody to know that we're all working together.
I just worked hard to try to build my name where I didn't have the money.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio political correspondent Jason Rosenbaum. Joining me via Zoom are two other members of the very, very fine St. Louis Public Radio political team. From Jefferson City, our State House correspondent,
Jacqueline Driscoll.
And from St. Louis,
Rachel Lippman.
So we're here because last night was an election, and there's a hell of a lot to talk about because this was one of the most unpredictable and significant primary elections of my 14 years of covering Missouri politics. This was actually Jacqueline's first election as a Missouri political reporter as far as a primary election. Isn't that right, Jacqueline?
That's right. It was an interesting one. My first ballot initiative I've ever covered.
Because there are not a lot of ballot initiatives in Illinois. So this was a new experience for you, wasn't it?
It was, and it was really cool.
We're going to talk about Medicaid expansion and also the upcoming governor's race in the middle of the show, but we're going to talk about the big news of the night, news that I've called one of the most significant developments in modern St. Louis political history, and that is Cori Bush defeating Congressman Lacey Clay in Missouri's 1st congressional district. This one not only sent shockwaves here in St. Louis, but it also became national news because it's yet another example of a Bernie Sanders-aligned challenger unseating an incumbent Democratic congressman. St. Louis Public Radio's Chad Davis actually got to catch up with Cori Bush after she defeated Lacey Clay, and she was reflecting on the historic nature of her win because as she'll mention, her victory marks a historic first for the Show Me State.
It means that now we have a woman out of all of these years in the history of this district. We finally have a woman representing. It means that we finally have a Black woman representing in this state. You know, it means that now regular people have a voice. I'm an essential worker. I'm a working class person. Now we have a voice.
Rachel, I know that this was not the primary race you were covering, but I have to imagine that you saw the result and also had some thoughts, and I'd be interested to hear them.
I don't have quite as many thoughts as you do because this wasn't the race that I was covering, but, you know, I reflect on it a little bit more, and, you know, you hear of things sort of as protests happen, you hear of a distinction between a moment and a movement, and we sort of saw in 2018, the sort of Ferguson protest movement turned itself into a political force in some ways with the election of Wesley Bell defeating Bob McCullough. And this is sort of a continued maturation of that moment into a movement, into sort of a real political force to be reckoned with in terms of, you know, elevating not only Cori Bush as a Black woman and a Ferguson activist, but Tashara Jones and Kim Gardner in the city, and just kind of, you know, establishing these Black Lives Matter candidates who really are taking progressive stances and running on them proudly as a force to be reckoned with. And, you know, there's you know, now a Black woman candidate running statewide in the Democratic nominee for lieutenant governor. So it's kind of been interesting to trace and see how this progressive movement that grew out of Mike Brown in 2014 and got Gardner into office in 2016 and Bell into office in 2018 is now really truly a force in a lot of ways. And it'll be curious to see if they can focus their attention and continue some of that momentum into November, where it maybe isn't their candidate that they're supporting necessarily, but, you know, turning their power sort of against someone, for example.
Obviously, the day after elections, reporters are really, really tired. They often are prone to hyperbole, and they often make statements that sound ridiculous. But I've put a lot of thought into this. When I said this was one of the most significant moments in St. Louis modern political history, that's not just tired Jason Rosenbaum talking. There are several reasons I believe that this is absolutely true. Number one, Cori Bush knocking off Lacey Clay means the end to a 52-year reign for either Lacey Clay or Bill Clay representing the 1st Congressional District. And I understand that right now a lot of people are not going to be saying very nice things about Lacey Clay because he lost to somebody who was saying he shouldn't be a congressman anymore. I cannot understate how important the Clays have been to Black politics, not only in St. Louis, but Missouri. Bill Clay was the first Black person ever in St. Louis history to create a political organization where it was around him and he wasn't subservient to a white political machine, as many Black political people were in the 30s and 40s. And by getting elected to Congress, he basically created an environment for Black candidates to succeed in St. Louis and St. Louis County. And even though I think Bill Clay gets a lot of the credit for this because he was not only a political innovator, but also heavily involved in the civil rights movement in the 1960s, Lacey Clay has been involved in Missouri or federal politics since 1983 and has handled an untold amount of important issues for the region. So the fact that this institution was defeated by Cori Bush is monumental. But as Rachel said, I think that the bigger reason, it has nothing to do with the fact that this is a continuation of like the squad expanding their ranks, sort of the AOC, Jamal Bowman, Democrats who are aligned with Bernie Sanders. The fact that somebody who was involved in the Ferguson protest movement is now going to Congress, to me, is one of the biggest political developments I've ever seen in St. Louis. If you would have asked me when I was covering Ferguson or when you were covering Ferguson, Rachel, that somebody in that movement would be a congressperson, I would not have said yes. I mean, what do you think of that particular point in this?
There was a sense perhaps of, you know, I saw a couple of people on Facebook post this quote. They had a meeting with Lacey Clay back in 2014, and he said something along the lines of when they asked him to support some of the policies that Ferguson protesters were asking for to come out and talk to them, he essentially dismissed it as, well, they don't vote. You know, how much of it is sort of a younger generation kind of making the statement and the point and saying, you know, we're not going to follow the mold of sort of older activism and we're really going to say, you know, it's okay for us to have been out in the streets. I think there is a lot to that of somebody actively participating in those marches, kind of rising to that level. I agree. I think there's sort of a level of complacency too from Lacey Clay. And, you know, he's been in office for so long, so rarely been challenged. And I think you sort of start to see kind of towards the end of, I really need to go negative hard in order to, you know, protect the seat that I, and protect the seat that I have for so long. I mean, I can't sit there and say that it's totally and completely surprising that a, you know, Ferguson protester would eventually, what are we now, 6 years later, rise to the ranks of U.S. congressmen, because we sort of have seen it with the squad and with others. They weren't directly participating in Ferguson necessarily, but they were participating in sort of similar activist activities. But yeah, I mean, like I said, I think it is sort of a true maturation of a movement that started in the streets of Ferguson to not just marching, but also, you know, truly organizing for causes, candidates, et cetera, and truly exercising their muscle when they don't believe that they have been appropriately served by the political establishment.
So we don't have township results in the county, and Clay won by 4 percentage points, but Bush won the city by, I think, over 10 percentage points. And what was really noticeable to me, especially compared to when she ran in 2018, is that her share of the African-American vote went up considerably. She didn't win black wards, but back in 2018, she was getting like 20%. And Clay was getting 75%. This time, she was getting like 40% or 35%. And there are some instances where she won a black ward outright, like the fifth ward. That, to me, was key. I said in the run-up to this, she needed to expand her support among black voters who had been voting either for Lacey Clay or Bill Clay for years. And she did it in the city. And I think that there's a lot of theories about why that happened. You mentioned the mailers, including one that derisively said that Cori Bush had been evicted 3 times, which a lot of people were like, why is that a bad thing, especially when we're going through an eviction crisis?
How touched do you have to be that you don't recognize that so many of your voters are also struggling with eviction and some of these issues? And I think that kind of gets back to complacency, a little bit out of touch. You know, I don't know that anyone is going to necessarily argue that Lacey Clay was super moderate necessarily. You know, he endorsed some of the same things and had some of the same positions politically as Bush did, but I think there were, or Bush does, but there are some of the decisions he made with the mailers that I think you're right, Jason, sort of struck residents as being kind of out of touch with the moment, as someone who has been riding high on, you know, being in Congress for so long and has lost touch somewhat with the communities that he represents and the diversity of those communities in terms of not just racially, but also economically.
I think that there was another reason I think Cori Bush improved among black voters, and that's because of something broader that was going on in St. Louis. And that was that there were 2 incumbent citywide officials, both black women. So I'm talking about St. Louis Treasurer Tashara Jones and St. Louis Circuit Attorney Kim Gardner, who faced really, really rigorous challenges for re-election. Some would say nasty re-elections. And both of those candidates won pretty sizably. In fact, I'm going to play a clip now from Kim Gardner, who won, I think, with over 60% of the vote, thanks to huge margins in North St. Louis City, as well as big margins in some South St. Louis wards with a lot of progressive voters. Here is Circuit Attorney Kim Gardner.
This election, for all of us, and even myself particularly, was the people's election, because I had people who never voted before say, I'm voting for you. I want to come out, not only vote for you, I'm going to work on your campaign and stand out for 13 hours when I don't even know if I got a home to go to. I don't even know if their last meal is what I fed them on their campaign. And they came out and they worked for me in spite of a pandemic that we all can die.
There have been a lot of people on Twitter and elsewhere who have talked about how this was a seminal election for black women in Missouri. And I'll open this up to both you and Jacqueline, because I want you both to maybe reflect on this, because I think that there's a lot of credence to this, especially when Missouri will likely elect the first black congresswoman, because the first district is super Democratic, as well as the fact that there will be 2 new black women state senators in Angela Mosley and Barbara Washington. And as I mentioned before, Tashara Jones and Kim Gardner both won. So Jacqueline, Rachel, what do you all think of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was the story that we saw on election night. This was huge for black women, for all of St. Louis. I mean, for the candidates, for the voters. It was just, it was really unique to watch. I know that I'm not from Missouri, so I don't have the institutional knowledge that you, Rachel and Jason, both have. But, you know, you could tell just by searching through the Twitter feeds that this was really monumental, and it was something that it seemed as though a lot of people were excited about and kind of had a little bit of restored faith in Missouri politics, you know, regardless of party. It just seemed like, you know, people were making diversity an important part of the discussion, an important part of the election, to ensure that their representatives were, you know, representing the people who they represent, the population that it looks like.
My dog, April, agreed with that wholeheartedly, Jacqueline. I agree with you, too, is that it was interesting to watch Twitter and to see people take in and realize, you know, the moment that was happening and that Black women would have such a prominent place in city politics, in state politics. And, you know, I think you're right, is that it is, you know, would it be as impressive, or is this just sort of Missouri catching up to sort of other states, the rest of the states? How much of this is just kind of a, oh my gosh, finally Missouri, or, you know, on the ball with some of the rest of the states? But I think you're right, yeah, that this is the story and that a lot of people are, you know, incredibly, incredibly excited about it, as they should be. And it'll be kind of interesting to see if that momentum is able to kind of carry through for those candidates, and then also for other Democratic candidates who aren't Black women or aren't Black men or aren't other candidates of color, just simply because people are motivated to go and vote for these candidates.
We'll be right back after this quick break with the Politically Speaking primary wrap-up show.
The Gateway brings you the day's news from the St. Louis region and across Missouri. It also includes stories from the Illinois side of the river and our Metro East reporter, Will Bauer.
In Alton, in Belleville, in East St. Louis, in Edwardsville, in Cahokia Heights, at Scott Air Force Base, I'm Will Bauer, St. Louis Public Radio.
Listen to reports from Will and all of our journalists weekdays on The Gateway, on the STLPR app, and wherever you get podcasts.
And we're back on Politically Speaking with St. Louis Public Radio's Jacqueline Driscoll and Rachel Lippman. I want to shift gears now to the other big news that happened statewide, and that was the passage of Amendment 2, which will expand Medicaid under the auspices of the Affordable Care Act. Jacqueline, you have done a lot of work trying to explain Amendment 2. Explain how important this is, because I think that I think that Cori Bush Lacey Clay was important regionally, and I think that there's some symbolic importance as well as some practical importance for St. Louis. But I feel like this could be the more wide-reaching decision for everybody in Missouri.
Right. This constitutional amendment, as I mentioned earlier, this is the first time I've covered a ballot initiative like this. So it was really unique to watch it unfold, and it was very tight for a really long time. Although Jason predicted that it would pass very early on in the night as he saw votes trickling in, I didn't feel comfortable calling it as early as you did, but you know the state better.
You know, the person that never predicts elections predicted it.
Never. Even when we did our most recent podcast with Mary Elizabeth, State Representative Mary Elizabeth Coleman, you didn't want to make predictions, but it was interesting. The constitutional amendment did pass 53% to 47, I think. At this point, I haven't checked the most recent percentages, but this will expand the government-funded health insurance program for low-income Missourians and those with disabilities. So it's going to cover adults whose annual income is 138%, I believe, of the federal poverty line or below. So this is really significant. Missouri became the 38th state to do this, which, as I've learned in covering this issue, it's been a years-long debate and discussion, and voters finally got the chance to weigh in on it, and another progressive ballot initiative passed. So I think that that's really remarkable. That's really interesting for me as kind of still a newcomer to the state, how the voters tend to agree with these progressive initiatives. When you look at raising the minimum wage, you look at Clean Missouri, you look at the right to work, now Medicaid expansion, also medical marijuana. It's just really interesting to see how voters tend to agree with these initiatives, but the representatives they're sending to the state house don't necessarily agree with those policies and tend to vote them down. I'm interested to see how that plays out, specifically for Medicaid expansion as representatives are putting the program in place in the 2021 legislative session.
And I've said that, I think I said this in the Representative Coleman's podcast, I think that Republicans have done an abysmal job of opposing ballot initiatives that they don't like. What their mindset is let's hope this doesn't get on the ballot. It won't get enough signatures. And then when it does get enough signatures, they run a underfunded campaign that doesn't actually match the enormous amount of money that's being spent on television or radio ads, which was the case for the yes side of Amendment 2. Given the fact that, like, it failed in a lot of rural areas, it stands to reason if the opponents of Medicaid expansion had spent, like, $3 to $4 million on TV ads, I think this would have failed. What do you think, Jacqueline?
It was really close. I don't feel comfortable predicting because I don't know the voter base as well as you do. But yeah, it was so close. And initially going into the night, I really thought because there was such a strong yes campaign that this would pass overwhelmingly. But when you look at the breakdown of how many counties voted no on this ballot initiative, it was remarkable. You know, this passed largely because of the St. Louis and Kansas City areas. So a lot of rural areas voted this down, which I also find really interesting because as I spoke with Tim McBride, the former chair of the oversight committee for the Medicaid program in Missouri, and he said he does a lot of work with rural healthcare, and this will largely impact those in the rural areas. And people in those urban areas aren't going to be as impacted by this. So the people who are voting it down are actually going to benefit from it more. It's just like, it's a really interesting dynamic of how people voted. And yeah, the amount of money that went into the yes campaign, it was unmatched. I mean, definitely for the no campaign. They're just, I mean, I don't have words. I didn't really see anything about voting no on this amendment, other than a few state representatives calling it out on Twitter.
I know there was a mailer that went out, at least definitely in the St. Louis area. I don't know if it was statewide that kind of played on the undocumented immigrant angle and that Medicaid in Missouri, expanding Medicaid in Missouri would allow for more undocumented immigrants to receive care and how you didn't want that. What struck me with this is I think there is sort of a knee-jerk tax opposition to some stuff that when you have your trusted local state representative coming out and saying, oh, Medicaid expansion is gonna, you know, raise your taxes, there's sort of that knee-jerk, I don't want any more money coming out of my pocket to benefit St. Louis, Kansas City, et cetera, that they're not making the connection between the fact that healthcare is also a rural issue. The way the issue is always framed is it's supporting, you know, urban individuals in low-income individuals in the cities. And that made it, I think, an easier no campaign, at least sort of locally. I was surprised a little bit too at just how narrow those margins were compared to something like Right to Work, which, you know, won overwhelmingly. But I think because it's so easy to just say Medicaid expansion could raise your taxes, it's, you know, just such a trope that people don't sit and say Medicaid will raise your taxes and all the resources will be dedicated to St. Louis, Kansas City. People don't stop to say, oh, wait, it may help the, you know, rural urgent care center that's down the block from me or this little two-bed hospital kind of thing.
Right. And I just want to add to, based off that mailer, that's 100% inaccurate, right? Undocumented immigrants don't qualify for government-funded health care from my understanding of the program. So I think that that's important to point out. But also, yes, Rachel, there are so many rural hospitals closing and they were huge advocates for Amendment 2, ensuring that they would get more money from the federal government. So, yeah.
Since this is a constitutional amendment, the legislature cannot come back in 2021 and simply repeal this. The only way that they're going to be able to undo Amendment 2 is to put something else on the ballot. The thing that I've heard the most is like a work requirement, which could blunt the effect of this. I've also heard that they would make it subject to appropriation. But all of this is going to require another statewide vote that I am almost positive will just be attacked mercilessly, not only by Democrats, but by hospitals that ended up funding a lot of this campaign. Jacqueline, what have you kind of heard from Republicans about what their next steps are?
So I spoke very briefly with State Representative Mary Elizabeth Pullman again last night after the vote came in on Tuesday night, because she's been a very vocal. She has been very vocal in her opposition against Amendment 2. And I asked her specifically about work requirements, and she said there's just no way that that's not a conversation come the 2021 legislative session. There's going to be a lot. She says there's going to be a lot of difficult conversations had. She believes that, you know, there may be something that goes on the ballot about raising taxes. Obviously, since Missouri has the Hancock Amendment and the lawmakers can't just approve a tax increase without going to the voters first, but also conversations about reducing the benefits that Medicaid offers now because they're having to expand it to more adults. So there, it's going to be a really interesting session regarding putting this program in place, see how it unfolds. Regarding the work requirements, there's some language in there that would essentially make it apply to everyone who falls in this Medicaid category. So, I mean, my understanding is that, you know, those work requirements would apply to pregnant women and people with disabilities. So it's definitely going to be, I think there's definitely going to be some heated discussions come spring.
So let's do some quick hits on some other races. First of all, in the least shocking news of the evening, the candidates for governor will be Democratic State Auditor Nicole Galloway and incumbent Republican Governor Mike Parson.
Who would have thunk that?
I certainly did, because none of the other Democrats or Republicans were viable, even though one...
I felt comfortable predicting that one, Jason.
Jacqueline, what can we expect from the Parson-Galloway showdown? I think this could end up being like one of the more competitive governor's races just because there aren't that many. But also Missouri is a Republican state, and I think there is some doubt whether Galloway can end up beating back the red proclivities of the Show Me State. What do you think?
Skew largely conservative, and I think all of the polls that we've seen have still said that Parson is still the likely winner out of this race, but I think it's going to get really interesting. I think the handling of the coronavirus is going to, you know, be a big part in how this election ends up, how the general election ends up, and I think that, again, as we see voters continuously approve these progressive ideas, it's just interesting to me to see the elected officials that they put into office. I do think it's going to be a really interesting race. You know, Governor Parson is conservative. He echoes a lot of what President Donald Trump says. And if there is a smaller margin of Missouri voters putting President Trump in office, I think it's going to be a more difficult run for Governor Parson.
Another race that was of note in St. Louis was the St. Louis County Executive's race. We did a lot of work on this show to highlight the four Democratic candidates. Sam Page ended up winning by about 9 percentage points over Mark Montavani, Jake Zimmerman, and Jamie Tolliver. Pretty comfortable margin, given the fact that both Montavani and Zimmerman just threw really vicious attacks against the incumbent. Rachel, were you surprised by the results?
Not really. Maybe a little bit, but, you know, there's always sort of this idea out there that you pick sort of one. If you really want to knock someone out of office, you pick one challenger and you sort of coalesce behind them. And what struck me about this one is that Montavani and Zimmerman are fundamentally different candidates, just in terms of the policies that they support, they sort of ran to opposite sides of the stage. So Zimmerman tried to, you know, outflank him on the left. Montevani tried to outflank him on the right. You know, maybe if you had, so you sort of had, you know, people could kind of pick the candidate that they wanted to, and not really. I'm not saying that I would have been totally surprised if somebody had been able to, you know, pull off the upset. I think especially with some of the decisions that Paige has made around the coronavirus. But no, I wasn't really surprised. I was surprised actually that Zimmerman and Montevani were closer to each other than Paige was to Montevani, and that Montevani came in second. I know there were some efforts to incur for GOP voters to vote for, to pull a Democratic ballot and vote for Montevani. I don't know how much that actually happened, but yeah, I'm not totally surprised that the incumbent survived in that race, just simply because there wasn't one challenger to sort of coalesce behind. And I also wouldn't have been surprised if he had survived in a one-on-one, because again, those candidates were so different from each other that I don't know how much of the enemy of my enemy is my friend would have come into play there.
Some of the other races that I was watching were some Republican primaries throughout outstate Missouri. And some of the winners include State Representative Elaine Gannon, who will succeed former Senator Gary Romine in kind of the exurbs of the St. Louis area and also parts of southeast Missouri. Jason Bean won the race to replace Senator Doug Leibla, meaning there will be a Jason in the Missouri Senate, which I'm very pleased about, regardless of party. Jason Holzman was there and Jason Kral was there, and they were both different parties. The Conservative caucus, I think, had a reasonably good night. Bill Igel won his reelection by a mega landslide. It wasn't even close, despite the fact that some people were spending a lot of money to dislodge him. Rick Bratton won in the race to replace Senator Ed Emery. And also Mike Moon will be becoming a state senator. He will be replacing David Sater. One of the really interesting results, and Jacqueline, you may have some thoughts on this, is Holly Rader winning over Kathy Swan. This will be the first time in recent memory that somebody not from Cape Girardeau will be representing that district. And I think the more important reason is she was a big proponent of the prescription drug monitoring program, which is an issue you've been following, Jacqueline. And I wonder if maybe this issue gets a little bit more momentum with Rader in the Senate.
Right. Now she has the opportunity to filibuster, right? Because she'll be in the Senate for any issues that she may see fit in order to get, you know, a discussion on the floor or to get the bill passed, because the Senate has been the roadblock in more recent history. But I also wonder, too, I mean, I've only been here a year, and my time spent with the legislature was severely shortened because of the coronavirus. So following them the way you do, I obviously haven't had the chance, but I also wonder how much like name recognition played into this, because Holly Rader's been there for, you know, she served both of her terms in the House. So I wonder how name recognition played into this, but she's gotten a lot of press in the years because of the PDMP and because of the support that, you know, we've seen statewide for this program.
Some St. Louis area legislative races that were notable. Kimberly Ann Collins will replace Steve Roberts in the Missouri House. In a couple of other, the one of the big upsets was Chris Carter Sr., who is an incumbent state representative, lost to Marlon Anderson in the state's 76th House district. And the two Senate races were particularly interesting. Angela Mosley won to replace Senator Gina Walsh. That's a huge win for the Walton political machine slash dynasty, headed up by former state representative Albert Walton. I think that this is their biggest accomplishment yet. And Roberts, who I mentioned earlier, will be succeeding Jamila Nasheed in the 5th senatorial district, which represents all of St. Louis.
One thing I will note, though, Jason, you brought up the Walton political machine. They actually had a loss last night, though. You mentioned that they were able to pull off a state seat, but Rochelle Walton Gray, the fourth district councilwoman, county councilwoman, lost her primary. So I'll be curious to see if that sort of shifts anything with the county council, if she's able to be persuaded to break ranks with the party and maybe serve as a fourth vote for the Republicans. Rochelle Walton Gray lost to Shalonda Webb, who works for Boeing.
And she will almost certainly become the councilwoman because that district is super Democratic. Kelly Dunaway, the incumbent councilwoman in the 2nd District, won huge over Creve Coeur Mayor Barry Glantz in a race that was seen as a referendum on Sam Page. And Bob Burns, a current state representative, will be facing off against Ernie Trakas in the 6th District race. That's going to be a very, very competitive contest because it's almost a 50-50 district. And I will be having Representative Burns on the podcast in the coming week. So we've talked a lot. I've made a lot of epic pronouncements. I want to leave this show with both of you providing your final thoughts on this primary election.
I have to say it was probably the weirdest election night I've ever participated in. You know, there's a certain rhythm to how election nights go. You go into the office and you eat your pizza because it's a cheap food to feed a number of people. And, you know, you're scattered to four corners of the city. And then you all come back and, you know, watch the results and you're frantically texting each other. And it's just, you know, I was sitting at my desk all night and listening to my fiance watch Simpsons episodes in the basement. And it was just a very different, you know, election night because of the coronavirus pandemic. And, you know, people were doing their speeches on Facebook Live instead of in person. And, you know, I have to imagine that November is going to be equally as weird and interesting, and you know, we'll have to adapt. But that was sort of what struck me is, you know, beyond the whole black girl magic, as Tashara Jones put it, was just, it was the strangest just sort of election night experience that I've had in, you know, I've kind of been covering election nights since college.
I want to second that. It was so strange not being surrounded by you all, and I was kind of sad because election nights are so just like, right? It's like our Super Bowl. This is why we're here and we all get to come together. And as you said, eat pizza when we get back to the office after watch parties. And I was like alone sitting in my room with a face mask on, which I mean, no complaints, but yeah. I kind of hope November I get to be with you all.
Well, my final thought on this is I was actually in St. Louis Public Radio's office the entire time during the election by myself. I know this is going to come off as bragging, but when I saw the final city and county results and when I added the numbers for Cori Bush and Lacey Clay and I sent out that tweet, I found out later that Cori Bush found out that she won based off that tweet. And whether it had been Cori Bush or Lacey Clay, that it really strikes me that to cover elections is, as a journalist, is not only an unbelievable honor, but a tremendous responsibility of informing the public and including informing candidates. And being able to be the person that basically relayed a historic moment to a historical figure, gotta say, that definitely makes me think and makes me a lot more humble than my giant ego will allow. And we'll be following a lot more races in November. This was the preview, everybody. We're getting into the main event soon, and we're going to have podcasts galore with candidates and issues featuring me, Jacqueline, Rachel, and other members of St. Louis Public Radio breaking things down. And for all of our stories, stlpublicradio.org. Follow me on Twitter at Jay Rosenbaum. Jacqueline, how can people follow you on Twitter?
Follow me at DriscollNPR. I don't make as many predictions as Jason, though, so give him a follow.
And Rachel.
At R. Lipman. I also don't make a whole lot of predictions. I just live tweet meetings.
I predict I'm going to go to sleep later tonight at 8 p.m. Until then, so long.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.